you a high performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. Hey friend, thanks for tuning in to Mind Body Peak Performance. Today we're continuing our mini-series on getting more out of your career, your personal effectiveness, and overall quality of life. As our guest mentions in the episode, today's topic is experienced by roughly 80% of high achievers. Yet most people that experience it feel like we're going about it on our own, like it's something to be ashamed of. Today, you'll learn how to flip the script, how to make it your advantage. Our guide today is Chris Kelso. Chris is a keynote speaker, entrepreneur, and the author of Overcoming the Imposter. Trained and certified as an executive coach, Chris has worked with hundreds of entrepreneurs, business owners, and their leadership teams. He is a faculty instructor at the Professional Christian Coaching Institute, an advisor and instructor at the Nashville Entrepreneur Center, a facilitator slash coach with the Alternative Board, and a contributing writer for publications including Fast Company Magazine and the Nashville Business Journal. Chris has founded multiple companies and has served on the board of directors of several nonprofit organizations. So he's as qualified as anyone to talk about this phenomenon we refer to as imposter syndrome. If you take away any gold nuggets from this episode, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review, or share with friends, family, or anyone that you think would benefit from this information. All right, on to the episode. Today, I've got Chris Kelso on the show. This is a departure from our usual health, wellness, fitness, and biohacking topics to cover something that doesn't get as much attention as it should. Chris is a keynote speaker, entrepreneur, and the author of Overcoming the Imposter. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nick. It's so great to be here. I'm really excited to have this conversation.
So today, what have you done so far for your health and performance?
For my health and performance today, I took a swim this afternoon, made sure to get a little exercise outside. And I ate a really healthy breakfast to get started, some good protein to kick off my day and make sure that I had a sharp mind. And then, of course, I have water within reach at all times.
Smart man. How'd you decide on a high protein breakfast?
I'm going to have to just be honest. My wife made it for me. So she came in with some scrambled eggs and stuff, and it was just what the doctor ordered. So it was great.
Perfect. So today we're covering something called imposter syndrome. And for those watching on YouTube, you can see that Chris has a big poster of his book in the background. What is imposter syndrome?
Yeah, imposter syndrome is a psychological term that was coined in the 1970s, actually. And it refers to the tendency of many people, it turns out, to overvalue the accomplishments of others and to undervalue or even doubt the reality of their own success and their own accomplishments. And so what happens is, you know, as an entrepreneur, I look at Nick and I say, well, man, Nick seems to really know what he's doing and he's got it all together and he's got this great podcast and he's really, you know, doing some great stuff and he's smart and savvy and he seems to really have a plan and execute it well. Whereas my success as an entrepreneur, boy, it sure has involved a lot of luck and timing and maybe just happening to know the right people or be in the right place. And there's a lot of mistakes that I've made, you know, a lot of trial and error along the way. And maybe I'm not really as legit as some of these other entrepreneurs that I see, or maybe, you know, I've only gotten here by accident and I'm just one mistake away from it all falling apart. Mm-hmm. And the underlying fear of imposter syndrome is that sooner or later, somebody, or maybe everybody, is going to figure out that you really don't know what you're doing, that you've just been making it up as you go along, that, you know, you're just figuring things out along the way and you're not really the expert that they think you are. And that if that happens, it's all going to come crumbling down around you. And not everybody feels it quite that strongly and acutely, but studies have shown that up to 70 or 80% of the population experience this feeling of imposter syndrome, of feeling like maybe I'm not quite what everyone thinks I am, or I'm not legitimate, or I've gotten to a place that I don't really deserve to be. That most of the population experiences that at some point in their career.
Do you think that social media and seeing the so-called Instagram highlight reels has perpetuated and made this problem worse?
Absolutely. I think you framed it just right. It's a highlight reel. We see the highlights of other people's lives and careers. And the problem is we compare the reality of our life to a very polished and filtered version of someone else's life. And so it's so easy to look at another person, especially on social media, where everything's very intentional and very carefully curated, and think, man, I just don't measure up to what I'm seeing in everyone else. And even if you're sort of participating in social media and you're posting all this great stuff and people are telling you, wow, you're doing awesome things, you know that you're only posting the highlight reel, that you're only publishing, you know, the great stuff, and that there's a lot of trial and error and struggle and fear and insecurity, and that things aren't as great as they appear to be. So those kudos and that recognition you get sometimes feels hollow, because you know it's not based on reality. It's based on sort of a half-truth or a very filtered version of what your life is like.
And even profiles of the major A-list entrepreneurs and celebrities, those even are subject to the same curation, where you will hear about them one day as the overnight success, but then if you actually get to know them, it wasn't overnight. It was overnight as a result of years of hard work, putting in the blood, sweat, and tears.
Absolutely. One of my favorite sayings, and I wish I knew who originally said this because I would give him credit, but I've heard it many times, that it takes a long time to become an overnight success.
Exactly.
And that is so true. If you talk to any of those people who just seem to come out of nowhere, there's a long journey to get there most of the time. And you have to work and strive and learn and grow and even fail your way in some cases to success and to that breakthrough moment.
Imposter syndrome is a topic that I stumbled upon through conversations with friends and colleagues, and I discovered that I wasn't the only one that felt this, and they felt it too, and then I realized just how common it is. I'm assuming you had a similar story because you've written a book about it.
Yeah. The first time I heard the term imposter syndrome, at least that I can remember, was in a conversation with an executive coach. And I, as an entrepreneur, have leveraged several executive coaches throughout my career that have helped me tremendously. And I have since gotten training and certified as a coach. And now I'm a coach myself, and I coach other business owners and entrepreneurs. But it was in conversation with an executive coach that I learned about imposter syndrome. And it was, as you described, sort of an aha moment when I realized that, oh my goodness, that thing that I felt has a name, and it's not just me, and I'm not the only one. And then as I began to study it, I realized that it is very prevalent. And in fact, statistically, it's more prevalent among high achievers. So the more you are pushing the boundaries and stretching yourself, and the more ambitious and aggressive you are, the more likely you are to find yourself in a position where you feel like maybe you're in over your head, or that you've gotten something you may not fully deserve. And so that's counterintuitive at first, but when you really think about it, it makes sense that it's not the people that are satisfied with just the status quo and coasting through life and punching a clock and collecting a paycheck that feel like a fraud. It's the people that are actually doing something great. And so the great thing is, now after years of study and hundreds of interviews and authoring a book, I've learned to actually see imposter syndrome in some ways as a great sign. It's evidence that I'm pushing myself, that I'm doing something worthwhile, that I'm stretching, and that there's really awesome opportunities on the horizon.
on this show, we're all about growth. And as you just mentioned, imposter syndrome is a sign that you're breaking past your comfort zone. And you don't grow by doing the same thing that you're used to. That's just the recipe for stagnation. And like you said, punching the clock.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That voice of the inner critic, which I call the imposter. That's why I say overcoming the imposter is the name of the book. That voice is not going to attack you when you're in your comfort zone. It's not going to try to convince you that you're a fraud when you're doing something you've done 100,000 times and you can do it in your sleep with, you know, one arm behind your back, et cetera. It's going to come after you when you're pushing the envelope, when you're stretching yourself, when you're getting outside of the boundaries of what you feel really confident and secure in. But as you said, that's where the magic is. The growth happens outside of our comfort zone. And so it's really important to get there on a regular basis. And when that inner critic tries to come in and say, you don't deserve to be here. Failure is imminent. You're out of your sweet spot. You're not going to be successful. People are not going to respect you here. That's actually all good signs of that you're doing something great, that you're pushing yourself. And if you can push through that and not let that hold you back, great things come on the other side of that.
Yeah, well, clearly we'll talk about that, because it's one thing to know that this problem, I guess, this exists, and it's another to know how to turn that potential weakness, the disadvantage of, I guess, being hyper aware of it, into a strength.
Yeah. Yeah, I've become fond of saying, and I got this from an old cartoon. When I was a kid growing up, I watched G.I. Joe cartoons. And at the end of G.I. Joe, they would give some lesson to a group of kids and they would say, now you know, and knowing is half the battle. And when it comes to imposter syndrome, I often say knowing is half the battle. And we already talked about this. You and I both had the same experience the first time we heard about imposter syndrome. It was like this weight was lifted and this great feeling of, oh my goodness, that's such a relief. But that's only half of it. Because if you walk away and you don't know what to do with that, then that voice of the inner critic is still going to be there. It's still going to be nagging. It's still going to weigh you down. And you're going to eventually forget and just fall back into those habits of self-doubt and insecurity. But once you know, once you're aware, now you can start to fight the other half of the battle, which is to counteract those arguments that go off in your head, to start to see them and build the discipline of recognizing that as a sign of good things, and then to put the safeguards in place with community, with people around you, with the right perspective, and know how to counteract those arguments and actually turn it around from a weakness to a strength. Mm-hmm.
Is there anyone that doesn't benefit from knowing this?
You know, I don't think there's anyone that that doesn't benefit from knowing, or that it would hurt to know this. I have met some people who just honestly say, I don't experience imposter syndrome. And for the most part, I believe them. Now, some people say that and they're putting masks on and they're trying to hide. They're afraid of admitting their insecurity, because it does require some vulnerability and some risk to acknowledge that you have imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. So sometimes people are fronting, but there are people that I know personally and know very well that just genuinely say, I don't ever feel like a fraud. They have sort of a confident humility about them, and they can, you know, they can acknowledge that they don't have all the answers and they don't know everything, but that doesn't give them fear or insecurity. They've just learned to really push through that. So as I said before, it affects at least 70 to 80% of the population at some point. So I'm never going to say it's everybody, but it is fairly universal and a very widely experienced trait and experience.
Do people experience it outside of their career as well?
Yes. And that's an interesting question. Most of my research and the work that I've done has been about business and profession and career. But I have had some conversations with people who say that, you know, I feel like a fraud in personal relationships, in friendships. I feel like a fraud when I'm trying to help others in ministry or you know, some other type of social good. People sometimes feel like a fraud in their hobbies, which is so sad, because your hobbies are supposed to be enjoyable. but people, you know, they can feel like I'm not any good at this, so I don't deserve to do it, which of course is, it's just a self-imposed limitation. If you enjoy something, even if you're terrible at it, you should just feel free to do that thing and enjoy it and not put the requirement of greatness on yourself for everything that you do. So it does get experienced in other areas. I think certainly in our careers and the work that we're trying to do and the things we want to achieve professionally is where it tends to show up most often.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the whole comparison trap. It's like, if you're feeling imposter syndrome about your hobbies, perhaps you're comparing yourself to other people, and that's why. Yeah. But if you were to be the only one on earth to sing, you probably wouldn't think that you were that bad at it.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And you have to accept the fact that there's almost always going to be someone better than you at the thing that you're doing. But their greatness doesn't have to steal your joy.
Yes.
Their greatness. In fact, President Teddy Roosevelt said, "Comparison is the thief of joy." And you can feel great about yourself until you go get into that comparison trap and you start trying to measure up. And all of a sudden you can feel less good, less happy, less qualified, less talented. And there's just really not any value in that. Certainly there's value in looking to other people to learn and to improve. And certainly competition drives us to be better. And that's a good thing generally. But when your comparison is not to learn and grow, it's to criticize yourself and to put yourself down, it's not healthy and it's not helping you. It's only hurting you.
Mm-hmm. So why would someone say they recognize they feel imposter syndrome? What's the next step for them? Like, why would they want to work on it?
So there's a number of reasons that you should want to work on it, because it's not just a negative feeling. It's not just an uncomfortability or an internal struggle. It can actually affect your performance. It can actually hold you back. I mean, a lack of confidence is going to show up in the way that you perform in your work, in the way that you interact with people. And there's also some psychological games that go on where we self-sabotage. You know, one of the traps that you can fall into when you have imposter syndrome is procrastination. I'm worried that client's going to reject me, so I keep putting off the call to try to close that deal. And eventually the client goes and finds another solution. And you say, well, see, that's evidence that I wasn't good enough. Well, not necessarily. It might just be evidence that you didn't do the job you needed to do. And so that lack of confidence or that internal mind game, that battle that goes on with yourself, can really hold you back. I have some stories in the book. Chapter 4 is kind of, I call it the downer chapter, because it's kind of all about the ways imposter syndrome can really hinder and hurt you. And I have some pretty stark stories of people who sabotage their careers because of imposter syndrome. And they looked back and realized that, you know, it was just self-doubt that held them back and caused them to perform poorly and ultimately lose opportunities and lose jobs. Now, there's some happy endings at the end where they figure it out, but it can definitely do some damage. And sadly, I've talked to too many people who, you know, are a little bit later in life and looking back saying, I wish I understood this earlier, and I wish I had gotten this under control, recognized that, and been able to counteract that self-doubt much earlier in my life. And my message to them, first of all, is regret does not benefit you. You have to forgive yourself, and the only thing you can do is move on from where you are. But you can help other people by helping to share this message, helping to explain and help people understand imposter syndrome and recognize when it's getting to them as early as possible and learn to build the muscles to counteract it.
And remove the negative stigma associated with expressing it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think one of the best statistics that we've already talked about is the fact that it is sort of a sign that you're a high achiever. When I share that with people, they begin to wear it as a badge of honor. I'm like, oh, imposter syndrome is not something to be ashamed of. It's actually it's a good sign that I'm pushing myself, that I'm stretching, that I'm outside my comfort zone. And so, yeah, exactly. Helping people understand that it's not something to be ashamed of, that it's not something to be hidden. And in fact, one of the ways we counteract imposter syndrome is to talk about it, to get in a group of people that are willing to be open and vulnerable and to begin to discuss where we each have our little insecurities and challenges and where our inner critic attacks us the most, so that we can encourage one another and hold each other up. And we can overcome imposter syndrome as a community a whole lot easier than we can when we're isolated and we're alone.
Yeah. On this show, we talk a lot about the things you can do to increase the performance of your mind and body. Typically, that's exercise, diet, sleep. These are all pretty big lifestyle changes. And for the average person, that might be too much. So if there's a low-hanging fruit, like changing your relationship with imposter syndrome, that's a great place for people to start. So I guess now that we've covered that, let's get into the brass tacks of how exactly do you work on overcoming imposter syndrome?
Well, there's two primary tactics of the imposter that you've got to recognize and then begin to counteract. And so I'll give you both of them. One is the fear of failure. The imposter, that voice of the inner critic, is going to try to convince you that if you try new things, if you experiment, if you get outside your comfort zone, that the risk of failure is high and that failure is fatal, that failure is a black mark on your record, that failure is something you need to avoid at all costs. And certainly failure in public is something you cannot afford to risk. So you've, in order to counteract that, you've got to change your relationship with failure. You got to change the way you think about failure. So I've got a whole list of stories in the book about people who failed their way to success. And some examples are Babe Ruth. He's widely known as one of the greatest baseball players of all time. He held many Major League Baseball records. Some of them still stand today. And his nickname was the Sultan of SWAT because of his slugging ability, his home run records. But his other nickname that not as many people know about was the King of Strikeouts.
Yeah.
Babe Ruth, his career total of 1,330 strikeouts was a Major League Baseball record for 30 years. 30 years he held the record until it was beaten by a guy named Mickey Mantle. So Mickey Mantle took the strikeout record from Babe Ruth, but these are not guys you think about as failures.
Yeah.
And they didn't just fail in private. They failed on the big stage with thousands of people watching. But what they understood was that failure is not the opposite of success. Failure is part of the process of success. They hit home runs because they took big swings, and they know that taking big swings is going to involve trial and error. You got to figure out how that pitcher pitches by trying some stuff and by trying to psych him out and by doing some things that are going to result in strikeouts and misses and occasional flubs, but they're going to eventually result in success. And so that's one of dozens of examples that I include in the book about reframing failure, not as the opposite of success, but as part of the process of success. Failure is learning. And so when I now endeavor to do something and that voice says, there's a risk of failure, that your success is not certain, what I counteract that with is there's two options that are going to come out of this thing I'm going to try. I'm either going to succeed or I'm going to learn. And failure is only truly failure if you learn nothing.
True.
So as long as I have something to learn that's going to make me better, that's going to make the chances of success greater in the future, failure is okay. It's part of the process. So that's number one.
Like when you are in a new, uncomfortable situation, there's a palpable feeling in your body as you realize that failure is a possibility. And a lot of us have heard like the whole idea that you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, meaning that if you don't try, there's no chance of success. But how do you exactly overcome that feeling, like the core feeling you have that says, don't do this, you're risking it feels like your life, but it's not.
Yeah. Well, again, it all comes down to your mentality, your mindset about failure. If failure is learning and learning is a good thing, and you believe that learning leads to success, you lean into failure. You look forward to failure. Not that you want to fail, not that you value failure over success, but you value failure as part of the process of success. And so you remove that fear. And when the imposter tries to tell you, when the inner critic says, the risk of failure is high, you should back up, then you hear that as the opportunity to learn is high.
Yes.
And so I should charge headlong into this situation, into this opportunity.
Yes. And that's something that I've been focusing on, is noticing these. I guess noticing is the first step. So once you notice, then you can retrain your body to reassociate that feeling with, okay, I'm charging forward, I'm pioneering something.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, over time, that becomes a good feeling, and you become, as I like to say, comfortable with discomfort.
Yes. And along that line, I wrote an article in Fast Company magazine a couple months ago, and maybe you can find that and put it in the show notes for this episode. The article is about reframing anxiety as excitement.
Oh.
And the basic idea is that when you're anxious, when you're nervous and your adrenaline gets going and your body's in sort of an aroused, heightened state of awareness because you're afraid of something. Maybe you're about to give a presentation, or you're going into, you know, a sales call with the biggest client you've ever had, or you're going to perform in an athletic event, or you're going to do something that you're nervous. Sometimes the prevailing wisdom is to try to calm yourself down. And what you'll find is that actually backfires. Because calming your body when it's aroused, when it's in a heightened state, is very difficult. And then the fact that you can't do it actually makes you more nervous. You feel like you're failing already because you're failing to calm down. But what I've discovered is that nervousness and excitement are almost the same physical sensation. Anxiety is the anticipation of a negative outcome, but excitement is the anticipation of a positive outcome. Both are anticipation. Both are an aroused state where your body is gearing up and you're getting ready for something to happen. It's just a matter of whether you're anticipating something negative or something positive. And so, as simple as telling yourself, I'm not nervous, I'm excited. I'm not afraid, I'm anticipating. This feeling that I feel is not fear and anxiety, it's excitement and anticipation of something awesome, of a great performance, of a fantastic outcome. And so by reframing that physical sensation that you're having, you can change your mind and it'll actually improve your performance.
We know that the words you tell yourself, the phrases, they do directly impact your biology. And that's what all of affirmations are about. I like that idea. I haven't heard that.
Yes. Yeah. So just reframing, number one, that failure is not failure as long as I learn something. If I gain something from the situation, so now I have an opportunity to succeed and win or to learn, and that becomes a stepping stone towards the next success. Now, the other thing that the imposter will do, the other tactic that you have to recognize and counteract, is the imposter will try to isolate you. And if you've ever watched one of those nature documentaries where they break down the hunting tactics of a pack of wolves or a family of cheetahs, you know, one of the things that they do is they identify a target and they try to isolate it from the herd. Mm-hmm. And we've already discussed at the beginning of this conversation that when you have imposter syndrome, you often feel like you're the only one feeling that way. And everyone around you seems to have it figured out, and I'm the only one who's sort of faking it and sort of, you know, pretending. Yeah. And that inner critic will tell you that you're the only one and try to get you to withdraw from people, to not be vulnerable, to not open up, to not acknowledge what's going on, to put up walls and masks and defenses to try to protect yourself. But that actually works against you, because when you're isolated, you're more vulnerable. When you separate from people, the voice in your head gets louder. The inner critic has power. The inner critic can just sort of have his way with you and work you over. And you don't have the perspective of other people providing a reality check and giving you reason in that situation. So the temptation is to pull away, but you actually need to lean in. You need to open up to someone. You need to say, hey, I'm in this situation and I'm struggling with self-doubt. I'm struggling with whether I'm worth this, whether I can make it, and not just anybody, of course, but someone you can trust, and to open up and be vulnerable, which is why I encourage everyone to be a part of some kind of community where vulnerability is the norm, where people are willing to open up, people are willing to talk about their struggles and their challenges. And in fact, if you're a part of a community and vulnerability is not the norm, vulnerability is not celebrated or rewarded, that community is actually going to work against you, because it becomes the social media phenomenon where everybody's showing their very best version of their life. And you feel like you're the only one that has a lot of cracks and flaws under the surface. But if you're in a community where vulnerability is the norm, where people are willing to open up and trust one another, then it'll actually weaken your inner critic. It'll starve the imposter. So vulnerability is a really key to making community work for you in this case.
I like that. And from what you just described, it sounds like the polar opposite of Instagram. The low light reel, if you will.
Yes. And that doesn't mean that we all just wallow in our junk and never celebrate anything good happening, but we have to be real with one another. We have to acknowledge that the successes only come alongside a lot of struggles to get there. And that it's all part of the process, right? And so when I try something and I fail and I learn, I should be able to talk with my community and talk about that failure. And maybe the pain that came with it was tough, but what did I learn and where is it going to take me? And then they can encourage me along the way. That's a healthy, supportive community, as opposed to a community where all you feel like you can do is talk about the wins and compare, you know, all your successes and sort of try to outnumber one another on those chalk marks of victories. That kind of community is just going to work against you.
How do you find these communities then?
Well, there's all kinds of communities, you know, there's online groups and there's local peer groups, and whether you're an entrepreneur or an athlete or, you know, in some other type of business, there's a million membership groups and things like that. The challenge is finding the ones where vulnerability is allowed. Exactly. And is supported. And so I'm going to tell you a secret to doing this, but it requires you to take some risk. It's not easy to do the first time, but it's very, very powerful. And that is to lead with vulnerability. So when I go into a new group, let's say that I'm invited to join a group of entrepreneurs or to come to some new membership organization or to be a part of a, you know, a social group or something, I will test the water by opening up first when I don't know yet if I can trust these people. I will get vulnerable and talk about something I'm struggling with. I'll talk about a fear that I have. I'll talk about an area that I'm just not what I want to be, but I'm working to grow. And I'll see how people react. And usually one of two things happens. Either I see some uncomfortability, maybe some defensiveness, maybe people saying, oh, well, that's not me. I don't have that problem. And I know, okay, vulnerability is not okay here. They're not comfortable with that. Or more often, people say, oh my goodness, I'm so glad you said that because I have that problem too. Or, well, maybe that's not my trouble, but let me tell you, here's my struggle. And it's very similar. And here's how I see that play out in my life. When you open up, you extend people a lifeline because you tell them it's safe to talk to me and to be real. And the right people will lean into that. And then you know you're in a community where you can trust and where you can be open. So I've started using vulnerability as a testing tool. I've used it as a litmus test, if you will, to tell whether the people that I'm with, the community that I've just engaged with, is the type of community that I want to be a part of. Now, that is not without risk. You may be shamed. You may be shunned. You may not get a good reaction, But what I've learned is if that happens, that was going to happen eventually anyway. And I just got there a lot faster and learned that I don't need to invest my time and energy into this group. So it's really easy to say that, and it's very hard to do it. I'm not going to pretend that it just comes easy. But once I saw the power of doing that a few times, I've just learned to use that as a test and say, hey, I'm going to be open, transparent, see what these people are made of. And then you figure out really quickly whether communities are worth being involved with and whether they're going to help you in your battle with imposter syndrome or whether they're just going to work against you.
That's an awesome actionable tip that I'm going to have to try. But before I do, I'm curious what you do if you're in a group and you say something vulnerable as a litmus test and one person makes a comment because of the negativity bias. All it takes is one person to say something and all of a sudden you might feel like the entire group is against vulnerability when in fact everyone else can be for it, but just that one person can sour the whole experience.
You're right. One person can sour, and it depends a lot on who that person is and how much influence they have already in the group.
Oh, okay.
Right. If they're an influential leader, then everyone's going to sort of tend to fall in line. If they're a little bit more of an outlier, then you may have some people come to your defense and sort of jump in and support you rather than support that negative comment. But there again, it's sort of telling you where the power dynamic is in that group of people. Another thing that will happen sometimes is if someone does react negatively or they're disrespectful or they shame or something like that, once they're away or when you get in a sidebar conversation, other people will say, I'm so sorry that happened, but I'm really glad you said what you did because that meant a lot to me. And so again, you sort of learn where the sub community is, where there's safety, or maybe you meet two or three people that say, yeah, this community is not for us, but we should go and find another group to join. Or, you know, so you're putting yourself out there as saying, I'm willing to be vulnerable. So if you want to engage that way, let's go. And if you don't, then, you know, let me know that. And that's fine. I'll just begin to distance myself. And you get a sense for where people are pretty quickly.
Okay. So far we have to view situations as either a success or a learning opportunity, and also to be the first one to be vulnerable. What comes next?
Yeah. From there, I would say, along the same vein of being vulnerable, learning to recognize imposter syndrome in other people and to open up and talk to them about it will actually help you with your own imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. You know, when you see someone else who may be experiencing that, or maybe even it's just a suspicion, and you just open up and talk about what imposter syndrome is and how it affects people and what that voice says in your head, then suddenly they're looking to you and saying, oh my goodness, this is so helpful. And now you've just helped somebody. You've increased your own value in your mind because you're able to offer something to someone else. You're passing along wisdom that you've gained just simply by learning about this thing that's going on in your head. And so looking for opportunity to help others, I would say, is the third key. And, you know, one of the things about being helpful, whether it's mentoring or teaching or training, that I think we get wrong so often is we feel like that in order to be a mentor, you have to be at some pinnacle of expertise. You have to be beyond the point of being mentored yourself. Like you can either be mentored or you can be a mentor, but you can't do both at the same time because that doesn't make any sense. Well, I think that's hogwash. I think that doesn't make sense. That, you know, there's no reason that I can't be learning from someone and turning around and teaching someone at the same time. So I'm an executive coach, but I also have an executive coach, and I get coaching for myself and for growing my business. I hire consultants and I do consulting for other people. There's no reason that it has to be one or the other.
In fact, I think that your coach should have a coach.
You're exactly right. Yeah. I've heard many people say, don't ever hire a coach who doesn't have a coach. So yes, if a coach believes in coaching and believes that everyone, even you know, the highest performing athletes have a coach, that then the coach should have a coach for themselves. Mm-hmm. And just that mentality, that perspective, that it's not take the class, build expertise, pass the test, get the certification, and then you're qualified to pass along some bit of knowledge to someone. But it's at all times, we're both helping and being helped. We're both teaching and learning. We're both mentoring and being mentored. If you take that approach, then you can find other people who are a few steps behind you on their journey, and you can help them along. And that will also help to build your own confidence, to quell that voice in the back of your head that says, you're not qualified, you don't have anything to offer, you're not valuable because you haven't reached the pinnacle of performance. You're not number one, therefore you can't teach anyone else. Like, that just, it doesn't make sense when you say it logically, but we feel that way all the time.
One thing that I heard, it was a quote about a course creator, and he was saying that you don't need to be the very best in the world to teach. All you need to do is be one step ahead of the people you're teaching, because then they still get value and they also feel like you're within reach and they're extra motivated, versus when you learn from some world-class expert who's the very, very top, it's like, I can never be there. They're years or decades ahead of me.
That's a really, really good point. You know, if I wanted to become a tennis player, and I don't play tennis, I don't, you know much about it, it would probably not be any good for me to go to Roger Federer and try to get him to teach me how to play tennis, right? Because he's so far ahead that the stuff that he's working on and the techniques he's going to use, like, I need a basics fundamental teacher. And so there's value, there's a lot of value in helping people, as you said, that are just a couple of steps behind you, that as you're learning, you can turn around and teach someone else and help them along the journey. And I've done that many times in many ways in my career, learning things and turning around and teaching them almost immediately afterwards.
Those teachers tend to be the most relatable too, because they just overcame whatever it was. And in your example of Roger Federer, he's not going to remember the basics of tennis. He learned that a lifetime ago.
Right. It's muscle memory for him. He can't even, he can't even really think about it because it happens naturally.
Yes.
So, you know, how are you supposed to hold to shift your body, and what the, that's all just second nature to somebody like him. But to someone who's just gotten at the level of competitive playing, they would really remember those days when it was a struggle just to swing the racket in the right direction. Exactly. And to make contact with the ball. So yeah, you're exactly right that sometimes the best teacher is someone who's just a little bit ahead of you, still within sight, but has a little bit more experience than you do. And we can all be that person for someone else.
In a previous conversation, we both talked about the learner's and explorer's mindset and how that ties into imposter syndrome and growth as a human. What does it mean to you?
Yeah, so Carol Dweck's book on mindset was really transformational for me. And I built on some of those ideas in my own book with giving her credit. So I talk about a couple of different approaches to dealing with the imposter. One of those being what I call the tour guide, which is someone who stays in their comfort zone, who wants to be the expert, who follows a script and makes the same loop over and over again, and makes sure not to ever go anywhere they're not familiar or comfortable, but to stay in their zone where they are the absolute expert. And they deal with imposter syndrome by avoiding it. If you don't ever get outside your comfort zone, as we talked about before, you're not likely to encounter the imposter. You're not likely to struggle with self-doubt. So that's one approach to dealing with it. But the other approach, which I think is so much more fun and gratifying, is to be an explorer. And an explorer is a person that not only is willing to get outside of their area of expertise, but actually leans into that uncertainty, that looks for the opportunity to figure something out as they go, to learn along the way, and to make some mistakes. See, an explorer realizes that taking a path and hitting a dead end, realizing it's not going to get you where you want to go, and having to turn around and come back, is not failure, it's learning. And again, it's that reframing failure as learning. An explorer says, I'm always going to get somewhere, or I'm going to learn about an area that will help me to get somewhere where I need to go. And so adopting that explorer's mindset, which is really about reframing failure as learning and being open to experimentation and open to the fact that I'm not going to be the expert on everything all the time. And that's actually good for me. That is the mindset that I try to embody. And I've failed at this at times in my career. I've definitely acted like a tour guide. And I tell some stories in the book about, you know, when I let the fear of looking inexperienced or uneducated hold me back. But I try as much as I can. And I work to build the discipline of having an explorer's mindset, being very growth oriented and looking for opportunities to learn and stretch and grow.
A lot of times experts are also, they have blind spots. Like, for example, one big one that's well known in like the health and wellness community is that in med school, most doctors only receive about 4 hours of nutrition coursework over the entire time there. And because of that, as new things emerge, they're not on top of the research. And so a lot of times the experts at the very top get left behind.
Yeah. I think it's really difficult to be both deep and broad. And so the deeper you go, the more expertise you build in one vein, in one vertical, the more likely you are going to have a lot of blind spots in the sort of adjacent verticals, like you talk about, that a doctor that's got a ton of education experience in medicine and treatment, they just don't have the time and the bandwidth. They haven't invested the same kind of effort in learning general health and wellness and more natural practices and those kind of things. So, you know, it's sort of like when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When all you've learned is medicine, then everything that's wrong, you want to treat with some sort of medical treatment. And so I think that befalls a lot of us, especially those that do put in the work to become experts.
Yeah.
And that's where we have to have the humility to say, there are boundaries to my expertise, and I've got to build relationships with the people around me that can help fill the gaps and to recognize my blind spots and bring the expertise that I don't have. There's a complex that happens to a lot of people who become experts, especially those disciplines like physicians and lawyers, where there's a lot of schooling. Yeah. Psychologists know that there's sort of a mental problem that happens, or a psychological problem, where expertise in one area makes you feel like you're an expert in a lot of areas. And so, you know, being recognized as an expert can sort of give you a false sense of a wide-ranging expertise in areas that you don't really have.
There's a graph I've seen of like knowledge acquisition, and it's not what you'd expect. You'd expect it to be linear. Like, the more you learn, the more you retain. But then it's actually more of like a sine wave where
you learn,
and then all of a sudden you realize that you know very little compared to what you need to know, what you think you know. And then you go down and then you come back up. And the farther you get, the more you realize how little you know, paradoxically.
Yeah. One version of that I think you may be talking about is the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Yeah, that's probably it.
Which is where psychologists studied how confidence correlates to expertise. And that as you learn something, your confidence rises really quickly, even though your expertise is still very small.
Yes.
And then eventually your confidence drops off because you realize how little you actually know. And so that first bump of a ton of confidence with very little knowledge is sometimes referred to as Mount Stupid, because that's the place where you feel like an expert because you've taken one class. Mm-hmm. And I definitely have been in that position where I've even, honestly, when I first learned about the Dunning-Kruger effect, I read one article about it and thought I understood it really well. And I was like, oh yes, I'm going to talk about this all the time. And then I studied it a little deeper and went, oh wait, this is not what I thought it was. And I had to dig a little more. So I experienced Dunning-Kruger while studying Dunning-Kruger.
Yeah, that's good. So I've worked in the tech industry for most of my career, and it's a fairly new industry. It's only been around a little over like 25 years, and failure in recent times has been celebrated. It's not just been normalized, but it's been encouraged. And I'm wondering if there's a point at which failure has gone too far and it should be toned back a bit?
It's a really interesting question. And you're right, in technology in particular, and in the startup world and, you know, tech company culture, failure is celebrated. And I think overall that's good because failure is learning, and people who fail have a lot of experience and knowledge that people who never fail just don't have. I do think that it can be overemphasized and pushed to the point of irresponsibility where people, you know, will just blow through tons and tons of money or resources or effort because, you know, there's no consequences to failure. If failure is great and success is great, then there's no way it can go wrong. And we're just sort of irresponsible and throw caution to the wind. Overall, I think it's a good perspective as long as it's maintained with some balance. And I think where the balance comes in and maybe how the way you factor in that balance is to understand what the stakes are, right? When the stakes are high, you do have to take failure more seriously. Mm. For instance, yeah. You know, I'm willing to try some things for the first time, just to give it a shot with very little education or training or, you know, and just put myself out there when the chances of failure are very high, even related to my business. But I would not walk into an operating room with a set of scrubs and say, I'm going to try surgery today. And, you know, if I fail, I'll learn something. Well, the cost of that failure is really, really high because a person's life is at stake, or at the minimum, their health is at stake. So there are situations certainly where just risking failure and seeing failure as learning is not appropriate. But I think it comes down to what are the consequences of that failure? And most of the time, the consequences of failure are overbuilt, are overplayed in our minds. They're far bigger in our heads than they are in reality. And that's the hump we've got to overcome, is not thinking that a failure on our record is going to be a black mark that holds us back for the rest of our career, is going to sabotage us, is going to sink us, it's going to take our company under, or, you know, is going to destroy our reputation. Because 90% of the time, that's just simply not true.
I'm with you there. Well, Chris, we've been going for a while now. I've gotten a ton out of this, and I'm sure my listeners will as well. Like I said earlier, it's a subject that is rarely discussed and needs a lot more attention, and the more this message gets out there, the more company culture and lives in their entirety will improve. So thank you for your work. And for those that are interested in connecting with you, either for coaching, to book you as a speaker, your programs, how do they reach you and what do you offer?
Yeah, I'm easy to find online as long as you can remember that my name starts with a K, K-R-I-S, Kelso, K-E-L-S-O. You can find me at chriskelso.com. You can also find the book specifically at overcomingtheimposter.com. And at either one of those websites, you can download a free chapter of the book so you can get a taste. And it's actually the chapter about tour guides and explorers. And so I dive really deep. I think it's probably the best chapter in the book. We dive into the reframing failure as learning and you know, changing that whole mindset. So it's a great chapter and we'll give you a taste for what the overall book is like. I'm active on a lot of social media channels from LinkedIn and Facebook and a little bit on Twitter and Instagram. People can reach out to me through any of those mechanisms. The websites have a contact form and even a button to book a call if you'd like to have an introductory call and talk about coaching work or talk about a speaking engagement, a conference or event you're doing. And I'd love to engage further and help you really wrap your head around this idea of imposter syndrome and learn how to build the disciplines to counteract that inner critic in your life.
Like we said earlier, it's one thing to know. It's another thing to implement and actually practice.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Let's move on to the question. One of my favorite questions to start wrapping up on. And that is, if all knowledge on earth is gone, you get to save the works of three creators that have most impacted your life. They can be, like, their works can be books, podcasts, YouTubers, whatever it is. Who would you choose and why?
Wow. That is a lot of responsibility on my shoulders. I think first and foremost, I would have to say the Bible. And I'm sure that's a cliche and a lot of people say that, but that's the book has had a profound impact on my life. And I read it regularly and wouldn't want to live without it. Wouldn't want anybody to be in a world where that didn't exist. Secondly, I think that I would probably look at, to contrast with all of the wisdom there, perhaps a really rich piece of entertainment, like a Tolkien or a C.S. Lewis. Mm. And then third, because I'm just so much of a psychology and human interaction guy, I would look to, either an Adam Grant or a Patrick Lencioni or one of the great management and psychology thinkers, maybe even Dan Ariely, who's done a lot in behavioral psychology. I really read a lot of those kinds of books, and I love to learn more about how the human brain works and where are the hacks and the tips and tricks that help us to think more clearly and make better decisions and see the world the way it is.
Well, it sounds like your book might be one of those.
Well, thank you. I would love to think that I'm even somewhere close to that sort of category, but time will tell.
Let's go on to the lightning round. Are you ready?
Yes, I am ready.
What's the worst advice you've heard around imposter syndrome?
The worst advice that I've heard around imposter syndrome is probably just get over it, believe in yourself. Just when you hear that voice of self-doubt, just tell it to go away. It's just simply not that simple. You've got to go deeper and figure out what's behind that and understand the psychology. So just telling people to get over it does not help. In fact, it makes them feel worse because they can't.
Mm. What are you most interested in and researching these days?
Well, I mentioned that I'm a little bit of a psychology nut. And so I read a lot of the intersection between economics and finance and behavioral psychology. So I mentioned Ariely, and he's sort of one of the foremost researchers in behavioral economics, which is sort of that intersection of economics and psychology. So that's something that I'm kind of always noodling on and learning about in the background.
Interesting. I studied behavioral economics, so I'm familiar. What's one thing that your tribe doesn't know about you?
One thing that my tribe doesn't know about me? Probably that I was a DJ in my teens and actually had a radio show that covered a good portion of Central Florida and would even be paid to come and host concerts and events and things like that. That's a part of my history that is a long, long time ago. And I haven't done anything in that vein in a long time.
We'll have to dig up some photos if they exist.
They're hard to find.
Well, how would you like to conclude our journey together tonight?
You know, I want to thank you, first of all, Nick, for having me on the show and this great conversation. Thank you for sharing my work with your audience. And I just want to encourage people that, if you've struggled with self-doubt, you've struggled with insecurity, you've struggled with this thing called imposter syndrome, not only are you not alone, but you're in really good company. Some of the smartest and most successful people have also fought that battle and they've figured out ways to overcome it. And so can you. So don't give in to the self-doubt, but neither am I going to tell you to just get over it. you need to learn about it, understand it, and learn how to turn that negative into a positive. You can see it as a positive sign. You can learn to use it as a guidepost and you can learn to lean into vulnerability and actually leverage it as a powerful tool in your life.
Perfect note to end on.
Thanks a lot, Nick.
Yeah, and thanks for coming on, sharing your time and wisdom with both me and my audience. And I'm sure this is going to be profoundly useful.
Yes. Enjoyed it. I had a great time. Thank you much.
I'm Nick Urban, here today with Chris Kelso, signing out from mindbodypeak.com. Have a great week. Thank you for tuning in to this episode. Head over to Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Every review helps me bring you thought-provoking guests. As always, you can find the show notes for this one at mindbodypeak.com/episode. There, you can also chat with other peak performers or connect with me directly. The information depicted in this podcast is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.